Welcome to Insight Mind Body Talk, a body-based mental health podcast. We're your hosts, Jessica Warpola-Schultz
and Jeannie Kolker.
Whether you've tried everything to feel better and something is still missing,
or you've already discovered the wisdom of the body,
this podcast will encourage and support you in healing old wounds, strengthening relationships, and developing your inner potential.
All by accessing the mind-body connection.
Please know, while we're excited to share and grow together, this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for mental health treatment. It doesn't replace the one-on-one relationship you have with a qualified healthcare professional and is not considered psychotherapy.
Thanks, Jess, and thank you for listening. Now let's begin a conversation about what happens when we take an integrative approach to improving our well-being.
In today's episode, my guest, Annie Forrest, and I talk movement. Annie is the owner of Forrest Coaching and Studios. She is a 200-hour registered yoga teacher, a strong first level 2 kettlebell instructor, and a certified TRX instructor. So movement isn't just about fitness. It's a full brain, body, mind experience that opens us up to deep connection, healing, and growth. Annie's here today because she and I both believe fitness coaching and movement practices should be rooted in radical acceptance and self-awareness. It's on this path that we stop hurting ourselves in the rapid pursuit of results and instead achieve our goals in an effective, neurologically safe way. We'll dive deeply into the ideas of mind, brain, and fitness. Increasing your understanding of your body is something that's empowering. And we'll discuss how to show up for your whole self in and out of the gym. Oh, Annie, welcome. I'm so happy.
I'm so excited to be here. Thank you.
Ever since I knew I was going to do this podcast, one of the first people I thought of was you because you have such wisdom to share. And I couldn't help but want to share what you have to say with the rest of the world. So I've been waiting for this day. I'm glad you're here.
Me too. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about your perspective on the new type of fitness experience, being a person instead of just a body.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. I think the fitness industry way back in Venice Beach with people lifting weights because Arnold. Yeah. And so it developed as this anatomical experience, right? Like way, way back, it was basically, how do you change your anatomy, your musculoskeletal anatomy? And over the past, how many years, 40 years, 50 years, it's shifted into this healthcare industry, almost like a subset of the healthcare industry, because people are going, hey, my knee hurts and I know I need my legs stronger, or my back hurts and I know I need my core stronger. Mm-hmm. And really, especially in the last, 2 years, it's become, I know that exercise will change my brain chemistry. So Can you help me with that? And obviously we stay within our scope of movement professionals, but we start to need to look at people as people, right? We can't just go, yes, you have biceps and yes, you have quads and yes, let's do that. If we're really going to help people at the level at which we have the opportunity, we have to back up and go, oh, you have a heart and you have a life outside the gym and you have hopes and dreams and all of this other stuff that's tied up in and creating barriers to and creating pathways for your fitness experience or your exercise experience. And it's so important that as professionals, we recognize that and honor it, as opposed to, why aren't you doing your squats?
Exactly. Which is why you became my coach for quite a while, in that I had an injury, which caused a lot of psychological distress, as well as pain, as well as limited my mobility and movement. And I had been trying to figure out how to navigate that path by myself. And I just kept hitting these walls. And then when our friend and colleague, Kristen Radke, referred you to me, I knew it was immediately the right fit, because you considered not only that I wanted to be able to squat again, but what is my nervous system feeling all day long? What is my brain doing? Am I feeling safe? Who am I as a person? How can I adapt and change my world in a way that supports my body, instead of just let me see your form in your squat and see what's wrong, right?
Yeah.
So that's one of the main reasons why I'm so happy you're here. Let's talk about how neurology and fitness go together. So let's share. Fill us in.
So it's twofold. I have a giant pile of certifications from a company called ZHealth that does basically neurocentric education for movement professionals. There is a company that came together and said, movement professionals know a lot about bodies, right? Yeah. Where most of us are highly trained in anatomy and physiology and movement and function and how the human body works. And somewhere along the line, we forgot that there's a brain that actually controls all of what I call the meat puppet. Yeah. You've got muscles and bones and things and strings that hold them up and we're this cool, like, really complex tensegrity marionette puppet that the brain controls. One of the things that Doc says is that you're always practicing neurology. You just don't always know it. So when you're doing a squat, you're not just strengthening your glutes. You're not just strengthening your quads. You're actually triggering reflexes in your eyes and your inner ear. You're triggering reflexes in tendons and ligaments and all these other pieces. You're changing your gut function just by going up and down and changing your metabolics. Really, even if you don't know anything about neurology, you're practicing it all the time in the gym. It's just a matter of whether you're going the direction you want to go or not.
What does it look like when you're not going in the right direction?
Yeah. So frequently it will look like one of three things. Either it will just create frustration, right? You just won't see results. People will come in with, you know, one thing or another in their history and they'll try to get stronger or they'll try to get leaner or they'll try to get out of pain and it just plateaus. And I saw this a lot early in my career where I was doing all the right exercises with clients and they were sort of getting better. And like all the textbooks said this should fix it and it wasn't.
I remember a moment training with you and you're like, how are you feeling? And I was like, angry. Yes. I get angry sometimes when I'm moving. And you're like, then let's not do that. Starting to think about that fight response is not where we want to be when we're moving our body.
Yeah. And that was actually number two. So you like totally got there for me is we'll see emotional responses. If your brain is going, I'm not willing to let you do, and I should preface this with your brain is wired for survival by prediction, wants to know what's going to happen so it can keep you safe. And if you're doing something that either it can't predict or it thinks isn't safe based on the previous experience, it'll kick you out. And emotions are a big one. We'll see people cry for quote unquote reason. We'll see people get really angry with us. We'll see people laugh inappropriately just for no apparent reason, just borderline hysterical laughing or like maniacal sounding laughing.
Yeah.
And that's a really clear indication to us that their brain is like, run.
Yes. That's so true.
Last output we'll see is pain. Right? If your brain is really not cool with what you're doing, it'll go stop and throw you pain signals. So back pain, knee pain, elbow pain, whatever. So if we don't see plateaus and we don't see limbic escape, we'll often see pain responses kick in.
Mm-hmm. That's why I really sought you out was pain. Can you describe the concept of the threat bucket? Because I've told people about this before, and I love the idea of informing our listeners on how they could maybe even do the threat bucket exercise on their own. Yeah. Okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah. So pain in our world is a request for change. It's an indication from your brain that something either could potentially go wrong or that something is currently about to go wrong. And not even that you've created damage, but that there is something going on that your brain considers threatening. And one of the exercises that we do with people is you've got a bucket. And at the base level, this bucket always has some water in it because we're mammals living on a planet that at one point was very scary for us to live on. Tigers and famine and lack of water and whatever. And then over the course of our lives, more and more threat, so to speak, goes in the bucket, right? You fall off your bike when you're a kid and you hit your head really hard. Wow, going forward in space often means I hit my head. Cool. Noted. Goes in the bucket.
Yeah.
Over time, that accumulates, and especially when there's a childhood trauma, when there's acute trauma of any kind, whether it's a head injury or an interpersonal experience or any kind of massive trauma event, puts a lot of water in the bucket because now your brain goes, the world is not a safe place to live. Let's operate on that understanding.
And so the water in the bucket is threat and it keeps rising. The level of water keeps rising closer and closer to the top of this bucket.
Exactly. And then when the last thing goes in the bucket, and frequently the last thing isn't the thing that's actually like the catalyst, which just happens to be the last thing in the bucket, you'll get overflow. And we consider that overflow to be a pain output. And it varies from person to person. Sometimes the pain output is chronic back pain or chronic neck pain. Mm-hmm. Because when you hurt, you'll probably more likely to stay home and in your safe cocoon. Mm-hmm. I share a lot of times with people, I don't really have the nerve pain and the migraines I used to have, but I'll have mood disruption. Mm-hmm. Right. The minute I start to notice that my moods don't line up with my environment, I know my bucket's full and it's overflowing. Because that means I'll stop interacting. I'll stop doing things that require a lot of fuel and resources. Mm-hmm. And I'll like cocoon for a little while.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it could be mood disruption, metabolic disruption, pain, like actual physical pain shows up that way. But it is your brain going like, too much threat. Please go somewhere safe.
Okay. Okay. And even things like not eating enough that day can be the thing that makes the bucket overflow, or it can be sleep disturbances. Yep. It can be all these different factors in our lived experience. So I know when we did the threat bucket experience, identifying all the threats going into this bucket, and then some we can't take out, some just we can't, but what can we do? Oh, if I introduce a snack midday, that decreases the water level in my bucket. If I purposefully meditate for 5 minutes in my car before going into the house, that might decrease the water level in my threat bucket. And then things of that nature may actually influence the pain output in my body. When having pain from a squat, most of us naturally think, oh no, I hurt something. But what if it's, hey, you don't have enough fuel. Hey, you're dehydrated. Hey, you need to sleep more. So I love the idea of considering all the different influencers coming in when pain is the output. And how can we explore if it's pain or if it's our body telling us it needs something? Yeah. And you introduced that to me.
It becomes really interesting because then all of a sudden your exercise and your movement practice becomes, how can I better inform my nervous system about the world around me?
Yeah. You brought up the nervous system. This is a great time to share something I have found in an article about the parasympathetic nervous system and recovery. And I want to see what you think about it. Mm-hmm. In this article, it talks about people who are more likely to experience challenges with recovery due to their nervous system state. In polyvagal theory, we have this ventral vagal state where we feel calm, safe, grounded. Then there's a danger and our state shifts into sympathetic. Then if the danger becomes a life threat, we either freeze or shut down. This article is talking about sympathetic dominance, how chronic physical and mental stress can overtax the body and the body's ability to adapt and maintain homeostasis and feel safe. For example, people who are pursuing weight loss on a calorie-restricted diet or performing at a higher volume of training may find that they're stuck in this sympathetic dominant state, or athletes training for an event and performing multiple training sessions a day, or clients who have a more stressful home or work life, or clients who have experienced chronic psychological or emotional stress. Considering that, monitoring the amount of stress a client endures in their workouts, what are your thoughts on it?
The terms that we often use are adaptive or maladaptive stressors. Adaptive stressors are where we push the physiological systems enough to force a change. And that's the whole idea of fitness, is you want to stress the system enough that it adapts and steps up.
Yes.
And then maladaptive stress is where you're pushing the system so hard that it cannot keep up with the demands that you're putting on it.
Okay.
So when we're looking at programming, right, a lot of times in the world out there, naming no names, there is a lot of like, push as hard as you can and it'll work. Yeah. How hard can you work to achieve change? And what happens is you end up in this maladaptive stress response where your nervous system is literally going, well, now I don't have enough resources to even get through my day. Mm-hmm. You're now requiring resources I don't have to get through this workout. So I'll just lean on adrenaline.
Okay. Right?
And it's not even a cognitive process. Your system just goes, okay, adrenaline it is. Got it, man. And starts this adrenaline cortisol cycle to meet the needs that you are, or the demands that you are putting on your system.
Okay.
The smarter way to train, you know, and the whole self way to train,
whole person way to train.
Yeah. So whether it's optimized or caring or both. A lot of performance athletes are like, I have to optimize my training. Yeah. And a lot of us, you know, who live day-to-day lives go, I just want to feel good in my skin at the end of a workout and the end of a day.
Yeah.
We start going, can we get you to a parasympathetic state by the end of your workout? And can we keep your system in a place where it feels safe enough to actually do the rest and digest and rebuild processes?
Yes.
Because when you're in adrenaline and cortisol cycles, all you're doing is basically surviving. Right?
Yeah, and your body yep. doesn't have enough resources. The resources are going towards yep. survival instead yep. of going towards recovery
yep.
and healing.
Yeah, and the whole goal would be, can you set up a workout that is hard enough to create a little bit of stress so your system adapts and not so hard that your brain goes, oh my God, I have to do something about this and kicks into too much adrenaline. And we use adrenaline and fight or flight as a dirty word sometimes, and it's not. It's incredibly useful and it makes really cool things happen. There is just a need to also come down far enough by the end of a workout, or often in cycles throughout a workout, to help your system feel safe enough to sleep well and allocate resources to recovery and metabolic resets. And, oh, cool, I can actually make the neurological wiring rewire, right? Like, it's expensive to build new dendrites and make new neuronal connections. And they won't happen if you're just slamming yourself against a wall repeatedly. So we want to create an environment in which you can actually rewire the neurological structures to go, hey, put more muscle there. Hey, create more strength and tensile integrity there.
Yeah. Right?
Hey, allow that muscle to actually contract harder as opposed to, please just don't die.
Yes. You know, there is a point where it's go until you feel like you can't go in a safe way. Go until you need to pause. And then you rest until you feel ready. Rest until you feel safe. And then go until you can't go anymore. And listening to that body and allowing for, you're right, that parasympathetic activation with sympathetic. Building resiliency, really, for life. And you're practicing that in the gym.
Yeah, I'll say all the time that kettlebells are yoga, right? Like lifting a barbell, lifting kettlebells, going for a run if that's your jam. It is at its heart, if it's done mindfully, it's practicing for life. Yeah. It's going, wow, I can meet resistance and I can do hard, hard things. And I can come back down and feel peaceful and joyful and engaged and ready for the next thing.
Yeah, awesome. All right, let's talk a little bit about behavioral neurology, something my clients want to know a lot more about, I'll tell you.
So it goes back to the threat bucket, really. It's this idea that change is really expensive. So making a change in your life, stepping out of your habitual way of being, is expensive. It requires resources. It requires prefrontal cortex activation, right? The part of your brain that gets fuel last and uses the most of it, to be totally honest.
Yeah.
Has to be prepared to make a decision that is outside the predictable pattern. So we go in and hear people say, I really want to do this thing, but I just can't seem to get myself to do it. And I'm trying and it's hard. And more often I'm failing, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This is I've tried so many diets. I've tried so many exercise things and I just don't have enough discipline. I just don't have enough willpower is often the language that we'll hear. And when it comes down to it, like building a movement habit in your life is hard because it's expensive. Mm-hmm. You're not only making the changes, but you're making the decision to expend resources on discomfort. You're literally expending resources on discomfort instead of reserving resources, and recognizing that first and foremost gives so much grace and eliminates a lot of the shame loop that comes up when people are doing the I want to work out, but I can't. I just suck at this. Mm-hmm. I should work out, but I can't because I just can't seem to get myself to do it.
Yeah.
And so just first and foremost, recognizing that you're choosing to do something dangerous and expensive instead of allowing yourself to do something that you always do that's safe and cheap.
Yes. Yes. So behavioral change is expensive.
Yes. Yeah. And if it's going to be one of those expensive days, instead of making it a big thing, make it smaller. So one of the biggest things that we teach people is to make it the smallest, most non-threatening change possible. So can you change into fitness clothes when you get home for a week? Don't even work out. right? Yeah. Just change your clothes.
I like that. Yeah.
And prove to yourself for a week that you can do something out of your normal routine. One really simple change that I've seen make a big difference is having someone fill up their water bottle and drop a Nun Tab in it before they leave work for the day. And simply proving to yourself, I can do a really small thing for my well-being, can actually push your brain into that space of, oh, it's safe to do things for myself. Yeah. It is safe to take care of myself in new and exciting ways.
Yeah.
So often the advice is, we'll work out 3 to 5 days a week for 6 weeks, and then we'll circle back and talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot, especially if you're going to go to a gym where there's bright lights and loud sounds and smelly things and weird equipment you don't understand.
The gym can be a life threat response.
Yeah.
So many people can have not only a danger response, but it can feel like a life threat to walk into a place that you don't know. Everything is brand new. The lights, you're right, are super bright. All this input coming into your brain, and you don't even feel like you belong yet. So even this idea of not belonging as you're trying to navigate, to figure out how to move, how to use machines, how to lift a weight. I mean, it's no wonder that 60% of people never go back into a gym after they purchase a gym membership. No wonder. It can be scary.
Yeah. So you start with non-scary, non-hard changes. And build a little bit and build a little bit and build. And I'm talking with my hands here, but you just add small little increments to what already feels manageable and safe. And again, we talked about sympathetic and parasympathetic that keeps you in a safe, relatively parasympathetic state when you consider taking the next step. Because some part of you has already figured out, oh, I don't have to protect you from yourself.
Yeah. And especially when our system is trying to decide, and that's every person, right? Neuroception, our nervous system is continually scanning, trying to decide, am I safe? Am I safe? Am I safe? Yeah. Yeah. And pattern is a big part of how the brain figures out if it's safe or not. It needs that pattern to recognize, yep, I've done this before. I've made it through. All right, let's keep doing this. Let's keep building on this. So the Forest Method, Annie Forrest, the Forest Method, it's for athletes, homebodies, everyone in between. You help teach freeing up the body to move well and freeing up the brain to allow the body to move well. I know you have 3 skills ready to share with our listeners. So let's begin. First one, sensory before movement. What does that mean?
So again, this idea of freeing up your brain to allow your body to move. You're constantly riding the gas and the brakes in your back brain, right? Your brain is constantly deciding, should I let you move that way or should I not? Should I hit the brakes or should I hit the gas? And one of the biggest reasons it would hit the brakes is if it doesn't understand that part of your body very well. Mm-hmm. One of the fastest ways to inform that part of your brain about that part of your body is to touch it. One of the first things we teach people is if you're going to move something, especially if it has had a previous injury, surgery, scar, sticky spot, sprain, whatever, you touch it first. So you start telling, what's part of it's called your parietal lobe. You start telling your parietal lobe, hey, there's a knee here. And it has all these different facets. And it's got the front and the back and the inside and the outside and the top and the bottom. And so we'll have people actually touch, like use their fingernails, like the back
sensory experience.
We use paintbrushes. We'll use like washcloths work really well. But just even if you don't have specific areas, but taking something and brushing your whole body before you start a workout actually gets blood flow to the part of your brain that preempts your movement patterns. Mm-hmm. Your sensory cortex lives right in front of your movement cortex in terms of that. When you start activating that part of the parietal lobe, all the little Christmas lights blink on and then it goes, oh, we should move. It's okay to move. So one of the first things you can do to improve your movement patterns and have your brain go, yes, you can move that, is to touch it.
Yes. I love this because when we were working on my squat, you asked me, and I still do this with some of the people I work with, can you bend your ankles? And everyone's, oh, yeah, I can bend my ankles. And then they try and their ankles don't bend very much.
Yeah.
Oh, and I say, do you think your brain knows where your ankles are? Well, of course it knows where my ankles are. And I say, let's really tell it. Let's map it. Let's expand that map. Sometimes
especially in regards to trauma, our body and our brain disconnect. Or if we don't use certain areas of our body very often, our body and our brain can disconnect.
Yeah.
And it needs a little bit of a reminder. So then we spend a few minutes adding some sensory to the ankles. And lo and behold, every single time, suddenly that squat improves and those ankles are bending.
Yeah.
Because we told the brain, hey, here's my ankles. Let's bend them. It's so cool. So for anyone, if you're feeling like you're struggling with anything of that nature when you're doing movement, add some sensory to it and see what happens.
Yeah. The only other sensory things, if you've got, have had surgeries, or honestly, if there's been trauma, breathing is a really nice sensory experience. If touch doesn't feel good, and for some people, touch is really overwhelming, just being able to breathe into different places on your insides and noticing that can be a really nice, if touching skin doesn't feel good for one reason or another, or it's just not working. Mm-hmm. So I like to double back on that as well, because touch can be tricky sometimes.
That's a great point. Thank you. Visual resets with movement. Let's talk about vision and how that influences our brain and safety.
So your eyes, if you look at like a bandwidth perspective of all the information coming into your brain every second, your eyes really have the vast majority of it, because it's how we don't get eaten by tigers or trip over rocks or fall off of cliffs, or it's how we visualize or see intruders coming to the cave. So evolutionarily, your eyes really have a lot more say in what you're allowed to do than we sometimes respect or honor. And in today's society, in today's age, we flood our eyeballs with unnecessary information that's moving very fast with large amounts of fake light.
That's absolutely true. Yeah.
Yeah. So again, you walk into a gym or you're doing an exercise routine online where you're watching a video that's very high flash rate, a lot of blue light, right? It's a lot of your bandwidth, right? We talked about that bucket even. There's a lot of the bucket that's going toward managing what's coming into your eyes. So when you're working out or moving or even just going for a walk, if you're noticing that you're starting to go downhill or something starting to ache, it can be really useful to just stop, get to a safe place, and close or cover your eyes to allow that bandwidth requirement to drop for a little bit.
So the
two big ones we most often teach are close your eyes for a little while and just decrease the requirement, right? Mm-hmm. And if that makes you feel a little yucky or unsafe, make sure you do it in a safe space, that you do it in a quiet seated space. Or again, if there's trauma and closing your eyes doesn't feel good, putting on really dark sunglasses, right? Mm. So you can still see your environment and it doesn't trigger that response, but you're reducing the light requirement. The other one we teach a lot is the 20-20 one. Every 20 minutes, you look 20 feet away for 20 seconds.
Interesting.
So if you're used to looking at a screen or a book or a person or your environment, every 20 minutes, stop what you're doing, look 20 feet away and hold a point somewhere in space.
Oh, that is so cool. What does that do? So
you have two sets of muscles in your eyes. You have your oculomotor muscles, and those are the ones that like move your eyeballs around in your head so you can look in different directions.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the ciliary muscles that actually control the shape of the lens, which means it gets clearer or less clear based on distance.
Okay.
So by changing your eye position, you start giving new and novel stimulus to the ocular motor muscles. So instead of only being locked in one place and very tiny little flicks around a screen, you get a bigger look out into the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then those ciliary muscles get to relax a little bit. So instead of being tightly controlled on the thing in front of you, they get to expand and soften a little bit to look at what's called divergence. And you get to open up into your horizon.
Oh, wow. I also read how sometimes treadmills or AMT machines, which are like elliptical-y type machines, for some people, they actually create a sense of unsafety.
Yeah.
Or they can be triggering because when our body's in that movement pattern, it's used to vision changing and what we see changing. And yet when we're on those machines, our eyes stay in the same place. And that can be a mixed message to our brain. Will you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah. The easiest way to explain it is that you have a graph in your head. You've got an x-axis and a y-axis that your brain is constantly calibrating off of. So you have this horizon line. And then you have a vertical line of gravity, and that's going to be your inner ear, the part that gets all swoopy in an elevator. When we walk or we run or we jump or we stand still, there is, unless there's been head trauma, information coming in going, okay, x-axis and y-axis make sense. There is a grid here. I get it. Also, something is coming toward me and then moving past me.
Yes.
So if I'm walking forward outside, I see things coming toward me and then they go past the sides of my eyes into my peripheral vision. On a treadmill, you will notice that things go up and down.
Yes.
But they don't come towards you and go past you.
Oh.
Right? So your horizon line is pretty neutral, but there's nothing moving past you.
Mm-hmm.
And some part of you is going, well, I'm going up and down. That little elevator slosh in your inner ear is going up and down, but it's not actually moving forward. So we get what's called sensory mismatch on a lot of ellipticals and treadmills, because part of your brain is, yes, I'm running. And part of your brain is, no, you're not. Something's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So it can cause.
Which maybe is why disruption. So people love running outside or walking outside so much more. I don't really know very many people who are, yes, I love the treadmill. I prefer that over being outside or even being on the elliptical machine. Maybe considering what is your emotional response to this?
Yeah.
How are you feeling when you're using these tools? Some people, not a big deal. Other people, nope. Don't want to do the elliptical ever again. This is a no machine for me. Okay, good. I'm glad we figured that out. Your system, that's a mismatch.
Yep. I have a lot of stories of people who do really well at an elliptical because their brain really likes the uppy downy, but not the forward backy.
Oh, so interesting. So it really is individual.
So individual to their own neurology.
Yes. Yeah, so just paying attention, creating that awareness around what's happening and what information you're getting from your body. Cool. Okay. What about chunking? Explain chunking.
Chunking goes back to a little bit of that behavioral neurology. So how can we take something really big and not understood or not safe and make it small enough that you can do this piece of it? We talked about sensory, right? Like touching things so your brain know where they are, making sure that your visual information is in line with what you can tolerate given your current circumstances. Mm-hmm. And then is what you're doing actually manageable? So if we take a kettlebell swing, this is one of my favorite examples. If I were to just tell someone, okay, go do a kettlebell swing, it's really likely that they would either do it wrong or they'd try to mimic what they'd seen in the past or they'd look at me like I was absolutely nuts.
Mm-hmm.
No way, man, that'll hurt my back.
Yeah.
So we actually take a kettlebell swing and break it all the way down into its smallest components and go, can you do what's called a hip hinge? Yep. And sometimes people are like, yep, I can definitely do a hip hinge. And sometimes it takes 2 weeks of practice to get into this particular movement pattern.
Okay.
When that movement pattern has been established and they can do it without thinking, there's no threat, there's no pain, there's no weird responses.
Yeah.
We go, cool. Now let's give you a little bit of weight and see what happens if you hinge with a little bit of weight. And then we stay with that chunk until such a time that their brain's like, yeah, cool, whatever, I got it, I'm bored. But it's taking any type of habit or movement and going, which component can't you do?
Okay. And that's so like the chunk. So you're breaking it down into chunks. Here's the first part, doing it with safety.
Yep.
Move on. Here's the next chunk.
Yep.
Repeat, learn until you feel safe.
The hard part about chunking is that we don't do it as adults very often.
We don't.
Kids.
I was just thinking about that. I was like, oh, Lord.
We don't ask a kid to write their name. We teach them how to write the first letter of their name.
Yes.
And then the second letter and then the third letter. You don't ask a four-year-old, okay, just write your name. It looks like this. Just do it. Well, just do it. But as adults, we somehow expect ourselves to just understand this massively complex movement pattern or complex behavioral pattern. And often the chunk is this little piece over here. That's the hard part that you're skipping.
Because you're doing it all at once. And how can you have true awareness if you're taking this big movement pattern and just doing it all at once versus slowing down, mindfully observing, figuring out where the shift needs to happen before you can move on.
Yeah. So just giving yourself permission to take the smallest, often very challenging piece because you don't understand it yet and spending some time with it and then plugging it back into the larger piece of the puzzle, whether that's a behavior change or a movement pattern change.
That's awesome. Thank you. Thank you. Annie, you coach and teach from a place of radical acceptance and grace, finding how vulnerability, consistent skill development, and focus on the whole self leads to places of deep healing and strength. You founded Forest Coaching on these practices, and your mission is to teach your staff and your clients the importance of the whole self. I love that. It really summarizes who you are as a person, as a coach, as a business owner, in that what we're doing here creates
and leads to positive change. Because when people are feeling better and living from their whole self, they go out into the world and do what they're meant to do. What does that mean? What does that look like?
So it's twofold, threefold, really. It looks like accepting and embracing every single human that we work with as being separate and beautifully different from every other person that walks in the door. It's recognizing that, yes, we are working with bodies. And primarily people are coming to us saying, I have a body. Can you help me do something with it?
Mm-hmm.
Move it, change it, do whatever with it. So the first piece is recognizing that it's fitness, right? That it's neurologically informed. So we've got the body, we've got the brain, right? Recognizing that there is a central processing unit controlling the thing that they are asking us to move. And part of our job is stepping back and looking for areas that may not be safe, areas that may not move well, areas that may be throwing out that hit the brakes or overflow the bucket response.
Yeah.
So we look at movement patterns and anatomy. We look at neurology and why it may or may not be allowing the anatomy to shift. And I think really what has made the biggest difference in my coaching practice is going, and we have these beautifully conscious minds and hearts that we're also considering.
Mm-hmm.
Because the central processing unit is great and it controls this really cool thing that we walk around in. And how can I help you see yourself as a whole, empowered, capable person?
Mm-hmm.
It's our job to teach you that you have the capacity and teach you to hold that space for yourself so that you can do it forever in every area of your life. It's our job to be emotionally and trauma informed as professionals and say, oh, this might be affecting your experience. And how can I help you hold that for yourself as well?
Mm-hmm.
Not just us being aware of it, but also reminding a client like, yeah, you've got some big freaking stressors at home. Please give yourself the grace to miss a workout if you need to, or dial down a workout if you need to, or recognize that it might not look the way you think it quote unquote should because you watched a lot of YouTube.
I really appreciate that. I don't think there's very many fitness agencies or fitness professionals who are trauma informed. And I would love if they're, you know, so reach out, people, if you want some trauma informed, keep listening. Because we're whole people. And if you're a human, you've most likely experienced some form of trauma. And it's those experiences where you haven't been spoken to in a way that is sensitive or caring or made space for you being human that adds to people's trauma in regards to the fitness industry or to movement or even to nutrition. I know you're big on fueling your heart as much as fueling your body. Will you speak on that briefly for us?
Yeah. The words I've grown to really enjoy is that you have optimal foods, right? You have foods that will, for your particular physiology, fuel you best. Right? Yeah. You'll be able to metabolize them and integrate them and use them best. And everyone's going to be different. There's no one way to do it. So you have your optimal foods. And then you have your easy go-to foods, right? The stuff that's quick and it's low stress. And it means that you get calories in and you can keep moving throughout your day. Mm-hmm. And then you have like your joyful foods. Mm-hmm. You have these foods that just, oh, like your body can relax. Like I sat in my car before this and I ate an apple cinnamon muffin and I drank a decaf latte with whole milk with the windows open. It was like, oh, apple cinnamon muffins are not an optimum food for me, but they're freaking delicious. And every part of my system was able to just relax from the sensory experience, from the self-care of going, I'm going to do this for myself and I'm going to stop my day and do it for a few minutes first.
Mm-hmm.
And if you are eating an optimal diet all the time and never nourishing your nervous, I don't even want to say your nervous system, nourishing your heart's experience of the world, you might get optimum performance and be really unhappy.
That's such a good point. And it's something we need to hear more about food. Is it satisfying us? Is it meeting all the different parts of who we are? So thank you for that. That's really helpful. For all our listeners out there, what can we take from today? Please consider your brain, your nervous system. Practice those drills if they help you feel safe. Integrate them. If not, it's okay to set them down and honor your emotional experience. All right. So I have one last question for you, Annie.
Yes.
I know you're a big fan of the polyvagal theory and autonomic nervous system regulation. Have you
ever watched The Karate Kid or Cobra Kai?
No, I totally missed this when I was a kid. And somehow, like, I have, because I missed it as a kid, I have not watched Cobra Kai now as an adult. Oh, you know what? I take it back. I did watch The Karate Kid. Okay. But I don't have any, like, visceral memory of it, and I have not watched Cobra Kai.
Maybe you will want to after you hear next week's episode. So, hearkening back to our 80s roots, Jeannie and I use the world of Cobra Kai, the hit Netflix show based on The Karate Kid, to bring original content explaining the polyvagal theory. The polyvagal theory is the simple yet very complex survival system that all humans automatically use to bring balance to our lives. We explore the childhood trauma of Johnny Lawrence and Daniel LaRusso, looking with great detail at how Johnny and Daniel's survival responses influence not only their lives, but 34 years later in the world of Cobra Kai, the lives of their children and the students they mentor. We are super excited. We fangirled during this whole episode because it brought together.
I need to go watch it now.
You need to watch it now. So anywho, Annie, I don't want to let you go, but I'm thankful you were here.
Thank you. Yeah, you as well. Thank you for doing this and for bringing this out into the world. And it's important to have it accessible, right? And just in terms of what time people have and bandwidth they have, it's such a gift that they can listen in their car or while they're going for a walk or just doing dishes or whatever. So thank you for putting this together.
You're welcome. Thank you for saying that.
Thank you again for joining us on Insight Mind Body Talk, a body-centered mental health podcast.
We hope today's episode was empowering and supported you in strengthening your mind-body connection.
Please join us again next week as we continue to explore integrative approaches to well-being.
Until then, take care.